Thanks for joining us on the Port City Church podcast. More information about Port City Church is available at portcitychurch.org.
Hey, good morning. It's great to see all of you guys and to be together. Thank you for being here. We are wrapping this series up this week called The More You Know. And if you've not been here, we started this series with the two trees in the garden. There's a knowledge of the tree, the tree of life, and then there was the knowledge of the tree. Let me start over again. Good morning. How are y'all doing, right? There was this other tree in the garden, and it was the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And we've been trying to explore this connection between knowledge and ultimately the idea of the truth and what its implications are. That's what we've been doing. And if you were here last week, I left you with a really simple statement. I said, or a question, which is why you can't just love country music. Some of you are like, oh, yes, you can. No, you can't. And I'm going to tell you why and how this unfolds for us today as we wrap this series up and trying to understand this connection in such a way that we find a way that the truth sets us free. Basically, here's the question that I wrote down when I was kind of wrestling with this a few weeks ago. The question is this: is it possible to know something in such a way that it is impossible for you to hate it? All right, so you're like, oh, hold on, this is too early for this. Is it possible to know something in such a way that it is impossible to hate it? In other words, can you know something about it that absolutely changes what you think or believe or feel, more importantly, about it? A few years ago, 2016, a friend of mine gave me a book, and the book is called To Hate Like This Is to Be Happy Forever. You can't see this very well. You can notice the color is Carolina blue, and it is the book is subtitled A Thoroughly Obsessive, Intermittently Uplifting, and Occasionally Unbiased Account of the Duke-North Carolina Basketball Rivalry. And it's got a picture of Coach Krzyzewski dressed like or made up to be a demon on the front cover. And so he gave me this in preparation for the 2016 National Championship where the Tar Heels were going to play Villanova. And so there I was, all excited. I love March Madness. I love my bracket. And I loved the final championship game. And I wanted more than anything else for North Carolina to get stomped into the ground. Right? I know, boo, it's okay. So I was all excited about this game. And I was, I was watching all the pregame stuff. I was ready to boo the refs. I was ready. I hope they lost by 40 points. I was like, go Villanova. I don't even know where you're at, but go Villanova, right? I'm just kidding, I do, but you get the idea. I didn't care. I just wanted him to lose. I wanted him to lose. And then I got this book from my friend, To Hate Like This Is to Feel Good or to Be Happy Forever. So I really wanted him to lose then. And during all this pregame stuff they were showing, there was a segment they did on one of the point guards for the North Carolina Tar Heels named Marcus Page. And this guy was such a good guy, and he had done so many good things. And I watched this, and I remember just like feeling a soft spot in my heart for them. And as the game went on, not only am I not booing them, but I find myself being like, whoa, this isn't so bad. And then if you remember how the game got down to the final 10 seconds of the game, and Marcus Page hits this unbelievable double clutch shot to tie the game with 5 seconds left. And I was like, yes! And I thought, what is happening to me? What is happening to me? Not only did I not hate them anymore, I actually found myself feeling some measure of affection for the North Carolina Tar Heels. Can you know something in such a way that makes it impossible for you to hate it? The answer is yes. I know that gives you a lot of hope for all of us Duke fans, right? It gives you a lot of hope. But it's more than that. Because see, it's not just can you know something? Can you have a knowledge that prevents you from hating something? Can you have a knowledge that does something else? Is there some way to know something in such a way that it's something else? Every person who's trying to convert me from being a Duke fan to a Tar Heel fan, they always talk about the number of championships they've won, the great coaches they have, the great players they have. They always talk to me about the facts. They say, you're eating from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. I want to eat out of the tree of life. When I saw that Marcus Page, I ate from the tree of life, right? There was something else happening here. It was connected to something else, something that was compelling, something that was deeper, something that was more. And this is what we have to figure out. You see, this is why you just can't love country music. Most of my life, I did not like country music at all. None. Zippo. And then something happened to me. My kids started listening to it, which is a step. But what really did it, in 2012, I went to see Taylor Swift in concert with my kids. Now, this is when she used to sing country music. And we were there, and I went to the concert, and I was like, country music, Taylor Swift, of all things, this is going to be really, really good, right? And it was me and Chris and our families went, and so we were sitting there like two middle-aged guys with a bunch of middle school girls everywhere. As we're standing there watching the concert, and by the end, we're like, Romeo, Mary, you know, marry me, Juliet. We'll never, you know, we're like singing the whole thing. We're so fired up. And ever since then, I've like enjoyed country music. Here's why you can't just love country music. You can't just love country music because someone tells you it's good or because you have to see something, encounter something in such a way that it compels or awakens your soul. You have to feel, it has to get that deep inside of you in order to compel you. And that's what has to happen for what we're talking about in order for it to actually change you, to compel you, to set you free. And what I found is most of us spend so much time in this intellectual pursuit trying to understand things, we don't allow it to awaken our hearts. When Jesus, and I don't want to jump ahead yet, but we're going to talk about this. This is what I want us to look at. So in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, verses 1 through 3, this we've been looking at over the last few weeks together. He says, Paul is writing this to a group of Christians, and he's writing about some disputes or some understanding about some ordinances, particularly regarding food and such, but I think it applies to everything. And he kind of starts off and he says, hey, we're all on the same page. We all know that we all possess knowledge. Everybody has some understanding about it. This is how it reads, verse 1. We all know that we all possess knowledge, but knowledge puffs up while love builds up. Knowledge puffs up while love builds up. So I begin to think about this. There's a knowledge that leads us to a sense of pride or independence, indifference, without regard, whatever it might be. It puffs us up. It gives us a sense that we are on our own, that we can do things on our own, that we don't need anything else. It puffs us up, makes us feel superior. We talked about that in the first couple of weeks. It goes on in verse 2. He says, those that think they know something do not yet know as they ought to know. People who think that they know some things don't yet know as they ought to. And I think these two are related like this. So there's two ways of knowing. There's one way of knowing that leads us to pride, where we get information that uses us to become more independent, more in control, more self-serving, more self-elevating over another person. But then there's another type of knowledge that leads us to love. That knowing and love aren't indifferent. It's not that you just close your eyes or ignore the facts or those things. That there's a way in which we use knowledge that actually drives us towards love. And that's what we have to understand, because it's not about the championships of North Carolina. It wasn't about the fact that my kids like Taylor Swift. There was something else that happened that compelled. There was a knowledge that I gained that compelled something else in me. And this is how human beings are actually wired to live. All of us are wired this way. There's a way of knowing that produces pride, and there's a way of knowing that produces love. And we talked about this, that to be loved, or to knowing and loving go together, you have to know some things about something in order to love it. There has to be some measure of information, some level of facts, some measure of truth in this. But it's more than that. If you read, Paul wraps this up, put the verse back up there. Those who think they know something do not yet know as they ought to know. But whoever loves God is known by God. This is a really interesting switch, because it starts to create this kind of loop. Whoever loves God is known by God. And I think the implication is that the more you know about God, the more you're going to love him, the more you're going to be known by him. It creates this sort of relational cycle, this way in which we just continue. The more I know, the more I love, the more I love, the more I'm known, the more, and it just kind of creates this way in which we live and lead our lives in a relationship with him. The question is, how do you love God? And I talked about this a couple weeks ago with the Orange Couch, if you remember that. If you weren't here, you have no idea what I'm talking about. You can watch them all online. But I want to reiterate this because in Matthew, Jesus would say it like this. He would say, you can't serve two masters. You can't give your life to two different masters. You can't be obedient to two different masters. And then he says this, because you're going to love one and hate the other. You'll despise one or be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. That's the context. You can't serve both God and money. Now the question is, how do you serve money? Because most of us think we serve God by we come to church, we do good things for God. And you go, well, how do I serve money? You don't serve money by going, oh, money, what do you need me to do for you? But all of us have an idea. We know what it means to serve money, right? We know what it means to be trapped or enslaved. What he means is to serve money, he says, when you serve money, you serve it by using it in such a way that it is your source. That's what he means. This is what I need more than anything else. This is what determines and drives all of my life. This is the source of my life. You can't serve two masters because you're going to love one. And out of that love and devotion, you're going to serve it in such a way that you use it as your source. The same thing is true for God. I'm going to put this back because I need it for lunch. The same thing is true for God. That you're to love one and to be devoted is to see him and believe him and trust him as your source. And whoever loves God is known by God. It becomes this relationship that continues to know and be known and love and be loved, and it creates this way in which we live our lives within that. That's what he's talking about. Whoever loves is known by God. There's some of us who think we know, but we don't yet know enough or in such a way that it compels or drives this relational dynamic, this relational concept. Now, last week what we did, we talked about this because there's something about the truth that has to set us free. And this is what Jesus said, right? There's something about the truth that sets us free. And what most of us use the truth for, and what we really do is we use knowledge driving towards the truth. We don't get it then. As we talked about last week, we use it to buttress our desires, our wants, the things that we already believe. And so what we do is we basically create or use knowledge, get information that brings us to a level that satisfies what it is that we already believe or what it is that we already want or what it is that we desire, what we want from this world. And we create, if you remember, we create these sort of sub-realities. For example, if you said, what I want, because anytime you use your wants or desires, you're actually going to yield derive a purpose. So if you said, I want to be happy, that's the purpose, that's what I want to be happy. What you're going to say is that, that you think that money will make you happy. You're going to create a reality in which you pursue money, and your purpose is going to become to create a world where you have enough money to do what you want to do. And you're always going to reduce these realities, whatever it might be, whether it's happiness or money or success or a family. If I just got married, then I'd be happy. And so we create this marriage and realize, oh my gosh, that made it worse. I'm just kidding. And we don't quite get there. We don't ever get to what the truth is. And you've got to, and it always goes, truth always has to do with some measure of meaning or purpose or why you're here. Everything that we live in these realities in here are all revealing something about what we believe about why we're here. If you're chasing all these other things, it's because you fundamentally believe that your purpose is to be happy or right or whatever it might be. And so I've spent a lot of time trying to think about this because I've thought about this. That what we're looking for typically in almost every issue is we're looking for something that will unify us. Because as human beings, we all want to be united. That's why, you know, we have world peace and, you know, whatever the tolerance and all these, we all want to sort of, you know, get along and feel good and all that stuff. And I thought of this. What I'm not suggesting is this. I don't think that what we have to see something compelling enough that's going to unify us. That's what has to happen if we're ever going to pursue, achieve that. We, you and I, humanity, has to pursue something or see something with such compelling beauty that unifies us around that which we see. And I'm not suggesting for a minute that you were made for 80s music, which I think most people ought to be. I'm not suggesting. We can't rally and go, everybody loves 80s music. I sat in the car with my kids. I thought, if I can just play them the Pet Shop Boys, they'll get it. And I made them sit in the car. We're like, love comes quickly. You know. And I'm like, what are you doing? They're like, Dad, we don't get this. I'm like, no. What's wrong with you, right? We're not made to be unified around 80s music. You're not made to be unified. I know some of you think this. You're not made to be unified around being a Tar Heel. That's not the ultimate unifying force in the universe. We're always going to be divided. The only thing that's going to unify us is the reality that you and I and every other human being has been made by God and for God. It is the only thing that will unify us. Which is really God's heart. It's our longing. And the only way it happens is that it gets done within that reality, that truth. In fact, I thought about this. There aren't many things that unify human beings at all. And I think the fact that we're made for God is the reason. And then there's a very distant second. Because no one's ever going to agree on which baseball team. No one's ever going to agree on what kind of music. Except there's another thing that might unify all of humanity, or at least close, or a distant second, is Don't Stop Believing by Journey, because almost everybody loves that song, right? Everybody gets behind that. But then other than that, there's nothing. There's nothing until you get to like this vision that God has in his created, in his creation, in his order for things. And what he said is this. He said that you, every human being, you have been made in my image. You've been made with my intention, and you've been made to bear my compelling beauty and the greatness of my love. You've been made to demonstrate, to live out, to flesh out my compelling beauty and the greatness of my love. That's a purpose. It's the only purpose that will ultimately satisfy the human heart and will fulfill the vision that every human has. It's the only thing. So what I do is I try to, and this is not easy work, but I try to say, so how do I get to a truth that keeps me from creating wants and beliefs and desires that create lesser realities? And it's to say that everything finds its meaning and its purpose in the context of its relationship to God. Everything that happens, I have to get it to, how does this matter to God and his image and his work in and through my life. So the marriage is no longer about being happy. It's about how does it display what God intended it for. Finances are no longer about how do I meet my needs. It's how do I leverage my life to demonstrate God's generous heart to other people. Whenever you can pick whatever issue you want, and it's always driving it to this reality. What's happening here? And this is not easy work. It's why I commend and recommend journaling all the time, because you've got to think things like, you're going to get some things driving in your car, like close to God. You're not going to get this in your car. You're going to have to stop and think and ponder and wrestle. It's the only way that's going to happen. Otherwise, we're going to stop short and create all these realities. The thing about truth that is so important is truth has to support the weight of your desires. Otherwise, you're going to implode. Anything that we do, he says, oh, if I can just get married, if I can just have kids, if my kids will be, and all of a sudden they bear the full weight of your desires and they crumble underneath the pressure. Your job, your relationships, it crumbles. The only thing that can support the full weight of your desire is the one who created you. And this is what he invites us, and this is the reality, that everything finds its meaning and purpose within the context of how it relates to God himself and the purpose that he's established. So here's how we do this. Jesus was asked a question, and they came to him, they're lawyers and religious leaders, and they're people who deal with like the loopholes and the nuances of the language and all this stuff. And they said, Jesus, which is the greatest command? Which is the greatest command? You've heard this before, right? It's recorded in Matthew 22. It's recorded in Luke. We're going to read it out of Mark chapter 12. Jesus, what is the greatest command? What truth, what principle is the most important out of all the ones that are recorded in your Bible? What are the ones that are most important? What's the most important one? And so Jesus says this. The most important one, Jesus said, is this. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord with all of your heart, with all of your soul, with all of your mind, and with all of your strength. And the second one is this: to love your neighbor as yourself. I love how Jesus took like license. They only asked him for one, he gave him two. Love your neighbor as yourself. There is no commandment that is greater than these. Now, what is really worth noting is that Jesus didn't just say, love other people, which is what a lot of us think. We all love Jesus, and people who are even out, it's like real cool. Jesus was a good humanitarian guy, and we're going to love people like Jesus loved. It's not what Jesus said. Loving other people is important. It is like the first, but it is not the first. To love another human being the way you've been loved by God is like the first, but it is not the first. The first commandment is to love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, with all of your mind, with all of your strength. To leverage every part of who you are to see and sense and understand his compelling beauty in such a way that your heart is awakened. I did a series about 4 years ago called Getting Nowhere about the condition of our brains, our minds. It was about mental health and other things. I remember doing research on this, a lot of neuroscience research, other things. I remember looking at this. If you look up almost every part of your body, there's a specific purpose behind it. Your circulatory system is to oxygenate the cells. There's a very clear purpose. Your heart makes sure it pumps blood. Your digestive system. I mean, everything has these real crisp purposes to extract nutrients and nourish the body until it comes to the brain. What's the purpose of the brain? It simply says, it's the executive center of the body. And if someone said, what do you do for a living? So I'm the executive center. Okay, what does that mean? What do you do? No, I'm just the executive center. What, do you like actually execute anything? Nope, just executive. There's a purpose. And it's interesting that nobody defines what the purpose of the mind is. Why did God give you a mind? So you can get all the facts to make your fantasy team great? But help me a lot. So you can learn a bunch of stuff about stuff. What is the purpose of the mind? My theory is that the mind is given the thinking, to put your mind to work and to think. The mind is given to awaken the heart. Do you realize that as human beings, you are more likely to drift towards predictability, towards doing the same thing over and over again, toward more and more efficiency? That's how you're more than likely. You're going to get your order into a perfect rhythm, and you're going to do that every single day. And you just become almost a robot. And then someone says, what do you love to do? What do you want to do? And you're like, I don't know, because I've been in this job for 15 years. I can't even think about that anymore, because you haven't used your mind to awaken your heart. How do we do this? The first command isn't a principle. The greatest command isn't a principle for you to follow in order to be better or to buttress what you already believe about stuff. The first command is for you to be awakened to the reality of God and his love and his goodness and his beauty. To be awakened. When is the last time that you have stopped and just loved God with all of your heart and all of your soul and all of your mind and all of your strength? Listen, I like to get stuff done, right? So I sometimes like Proverbs. I like Proverbs because they're like tweets, man. If Solomon was a Twitter guy, this would be his tweets. Proverbs. Just give me Proverbs. There's no fluff. There's no frills. And then Psalms is like, bless the Lord, O my soul, and forget not all his benefits. And you're just reading. It's like, whoa, come on. Can you get to the point? You ever read Psalms and thought, can you just get to the point and understand what I read? And you're reading them because what you're doing is you're using your mind to try to find something that's going to help you do something. Instead of hearing God invite you to know him in such a way that you see his compelling beauty. It's why we sing. It's why we sing. It's why our hearts are moved by all the things that we do in that way, we can feel something deeply. To use your mind to understand and drive things to the truth. Pick whatever sin you've wrestled with in the course of your life. Is it pride? Is it envy? Is it lust? Is it gossip? Did I leave anybody out? Is it jealousy or envy? Now we got everybody. What do? We want to know enough to sort of correct ourselves. We want to get enough where we can figure out how to deal with what it is we're struggling with instead of driving. I said, why does this matter in God's purposes? God says to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength, and to love, second, love your neighbor as yourself. That our love for our neighbors is important, but it needs to be an expression of our relationship to God. And our relationship to God is not a means to an end. It's not, I'm going to love God so then I can love people. That's enough. It's enough for you to see God and to be compelled by him. And people ask me after the first service, like, well, how do you do this? You can't do this in a hurry. You can't do this on the way to work. I sit down and I say, God, this has been years and years. Some of these phrases, to think of everything finds its meaning and purpose in the context of its relationship to God, was a 3-year-long sentence. It was pages of journals, and it's not nice, neat prose. Sometimes it's just questions. By starting saying, God, what is the implication of the gospel on me right here, right now? What does it mean? And I put my mind to work, to awaken my heart, to feel and understand God's love for me in such a way. And the way I wrote this down in my notes is that when Jesus was asked about what is the truth, he defined it as a relationship. It's really interesting. If you ask me what's the most important truth, I'd say the most important truth, and I'd give you some principle to live by. And Jesus said, he invited us into a relationship. The most important truth is to love God and love others. And he defined it relationally. And the way this works is, and it's Proverbs 3, trust the Lord with all of your heart. Do not lean on your own understanding. In all of your ways, acknowledge him. To acknowledge the truth. To acknowledge the truth so that you can bring stuff to him in such a way that does something in your heart. Last week, right, we woke up on Monday morning to the news of the shooting in Las Vegas. I did what everybody does. You scratch your head and you start going, how can this happen? How can this happen? How does God allow this to happen? All the questions that everybody has go through my brain just like they go through yours. And so what I did is I have a couple of go-to verses that I go to, go-to places. Psalm 46, John 16. Psalm 46, the Lord is my refuge and my strength. He is an ever-present help in times of trouble. Therefore, I will not be afraid, even though the earth gives way and the mountains fall into the sea. What I want is, God, why don't you do things the way I would do them? He's like, I haven't promised you that your happiness or even your survival is the number one goal. What I've promised you is that my image is to be on display in and through everything that happens in this broken world that we live in. And Jesus said it like this: I've told you all these things so that you'll have peace. In the world, you're going to have trouble. Take heart. I have overcome the world. You need something that can hold and sustain the weight of the desire that you feel in those moments, whether it's grief or sadness or just pure want and joy. John Ortberg's written a great book called Soul Keeping. In there, he makes a couple of brilliant observations. Maybe one of the best books I've read in the last few years, Soul Keeping by John Ortberg. And he observes, Ken Dunnington wrote these words. He says, we are limited. Human beings are limited in every way but one. We have unlimited desire. We want and we want and we want more and more and more, right? It starts when we're 7. We go, if I just had this diving set, I'll never want anything else. And then it's a car, and then it's a wife, and then it's a kid, and then it's a house, and then just on and on and on. We just want. We're endless in our wants. And John Ortberg writes these words: the soul's infinite capacity to desire is the mirror of God's infinite capacity to give. What if it were true that the reason you want and the depth that you want has nothing to do with all the things that we see, feel, taste, and touch, or possess, or control, or enjoy? But there were actually a longing within the context of your relationship to God that you would come to find him to be the source and the fulfillment of all satisfaction and fulfilled hope in your life in 150 years. What if that were how you thought about this? How does it frame the way you deal with stuff here? It changes because there's a reality, right? There's a reality. So you've got to acknowledge, and you have to live your life in a way that accounts for truth. And sometimes the way we account for God's truth doesn't line up with our plans and our ways or what we would do if we were God. This is why it requires a relationship. So back to my beloved Tar Heels. And if you're new, you're like, does Mike really like the Tar Heels? No, I don't. What happened in that game? There was about 5 seconds left. Marcus Page does a double clutch, hits a three-pointer to tie the game 74-74. It is unbelievable. And I'm like, not letting anybody know, but I'm like, whoa, that's pretty good. I'm moved. Marcus Page has done that for me. I'm not telling my friends yet, but I'm still moved. And then the unthinkable happens. Villanova brings the ball in, comes down, hits a game-winning buzzer beater to steal the national championship from the North Carolina Tar Heels. And my Duke-loving heart broke. Oh, why would what breaks my heart be the thing that breaks Marcus Page's heart? The reason was because for just a moment, I knew him in a compelling way. It was short-lived, though. Do you know why? Because anytime any feel-good story about Carolina came on, I turned it off. I don't want to watch it. Because I didn't want any information that would mess up what I already wanted and believed. I didn't want anything else. Now, what if me loving Marcus Page for that 10 minutes would have reciprocated in him calling me up and saying, hey, Mike, tough game. What? Oh, Marcus, man, it broke my heart. Let's go get coffee. Let's hang out. Let's talk. I might have become a Carolina fan. Might have happened. Some of you are cheering. Finally got saved, right? Do you see the difference? Because if we're honest, there are times when we don't want to know anything more. We don't want to know anything that's going to change what we already think or feel or believe or want. We like the things that we like, and we like the things that we hate. We like our lives like that. And Jesus comes along and says, you're never going to be free apart from a relationship with me. And when he talks about the truth being hard, it's not hard because or the truth hurting. It doesn't hurt because it's mean. It hurts because it actually takes away what we hold on to so desperately. But it's the only way in which we find ourselves free. Paul wrote it this way later on in a letter to the Corinthians, and he said in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, and it's an incredible passage, it's about reconciliation, about God longs to reconcile all people to himself, and he does this through what his son Jesus did, setting us free. That's what he talks about. And in there he writes these one little word. He says, the love of Christ compels us. I no longer see people the way I used to see them because the love of Christ compels me. There's something that we see about him that compels us. There's something that I saw about Marcus Page that compelled me to cheer for the Tar Heels and to be broken over the things that broke the Tar Heels' hearts. And I deliberately chose not to deal with it anymore. Because I don't want to be broken over the things that break the Tar Heels' hearts. I want the Tar Heels' hearts to be broken, right? So what about if we learn to see Jesus in the same way? If you learn to see Jesus in such a way that you long for the things that he longed for, and the things that broke his heart came to break your heart, and it can be short-lived if you don't continue the relationship. Putting your mind to work to understand not just how Jesus intervenes in the problems that you're currently facing, but how does he help you develop a long-term understanding, seeing the world around us in such a way. Y'all, it takes time and energy to love God with your heart and your soul and your mind and your strength. But what I found is this, and this is really what I believe is the telltale about this, that when Jesus calls him into relationship with him, there is what I would call a freeing truth, a truth that sets us free. So when I pray, this is what I do. When I don't understand, I do what I did in Psalm 46. I say, God, I want to drive this all the way to you. I want to drive this all the way to you. Because sometimes I get far enough where it just makes me mad or it validates what I already believe or allows me to be right or a host of other things, and I haven't driven it far. It doesn't set me free. It just proves my point. Psalm 25, it says, he writes this, this is actually several, he says, teach me, Father, your ways, that I may trust in you. Teach me, God, what you want so I can trust in you. Not so I can know what to do. Teach me so I can trust. Praise God, guide me in truth. The Holy Spirit is given to us in the gospel to lead us, to awaken us, to help us to process and understand what is true. And we've got to keep driving it to him. And the way I would define this, the way you can tell is this, that freeing truth always compels you to love. If truth doesn't compel you to love, you haven't driven it far enough to set you free. Some of you have driven it far enough to prove your point. You've driven it far enough to know that you're right. You've driven it far enough to kind of cap your behavior or someone else's behavior. But you haven't driven it to the point where your affections are actually moved towards God and towards another human being. And if you haven't driven it that far, you haven't driven it far enough to set you free. So what do you do about this? I wish I could say, just go out and love people. It's so funny. I watch all the stuff on the, checking the time. I'm trying to see if I want to say this or not. I'm not. Let me say it like this. Because there are times when you see controversial topics in the news. And then someone comes back and they immediately like recant or apologize. And everybody talks about, well, this person, did they really mean it? What were they doing? And the answer is no, they didn't. And the reason is not because they're bad or malicious. Because you don't do this in 24 hours. You don't say something and then process it deeply enough in that kind of time. And my point is, this is not something you're going to do gut reactions to. You're going to have to say, God, what are these things really? And how do I drive them? How do I drive them to your purpose so that your image gets seen in my life? Not because I'm trying to get it seen, but because I'm so moved by it. I actually live that out. That's where we're going with this. And it's just going to take work. Use your mind to awaken your heart. Right? If the truth doesn't compel you to love, you haven't driven it far enough to be free. Let's pray together. God, thank you for your goodness and your patience. And God, I just ask right now that your Holy Spirit would fulfill the promised role of being our advocate and being the one who awakens truth in us. God, for those who are here and have a relationship with your son Jesus, I pray that you would cause them to enjoy it, to depend on it, to see it as source, that we might love you and be devoted to you. God, awaken us. Show us your compelling beauty and glory in such a way that we are moved to express that, to give of ourselves. God, for those who are not sure where they stand in their relationship with you, they might believe things about you, but they've never known you enough to be compelled. God, I pray that you would do that. You would reveal yourself to them in a way that compels them, draws them. God, I ask that you would do this so that in our world where it is seemingly completely unhinged, that peace is found by your presence, and that you would use us, your people, your followers, to bring that peace to a world that desperately needs it, to bring that love to a world that desperately needs it. And in doing so, you would be seen and known and glorified. And that is my hope, and that is my prayer, and I ask this thing of your son, Jesus. Amen.